thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 97, Digital Potato Library of America. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Digital Campus. We are shocked and horrified to realize that this will be episode 97. The last one was 96. And so we have yet to form any plans for the 100th episode of Digital Campus. But we nevertheless have a very special Digital Campus for you today. We have a couple of eminent guests. We have, as usual, our regulars, Dan Cohen. Hello, Dan.
Hey, Amanda.
Mills Kelly. Hello, Mills.
Hello, Mills.
Hello, Amanda.
But we also have two very renowned guests. We are joined by Nicholas Carr, who is a writer and author most recently of The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, and before that, The Big Switch, Rewiring the World from Edison to Google. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Amanda.
Thank you very much for joining us. We are also joined by David Weinberger, who is also an author and as well is at Harvard. David has written some of my favorite books, including most recently Too Big to Know, Rethinking Knowledge Now That the Facts Aren't the Facts, Experts Are Everywhere, and The Smartest Person in the Room is the Room. And before that, Everything is Miscellaneous, The Power of the New Digital Disorder. Hello, David.
Hi, Amanda.
So in general on Digital Campus, we often do a kind of a rundown of recent news headlines, and there certainly have been, items in the news recently that do affect universities, libraries, archives, and museums who are attempting to do things with digital tools. But we thought we would change the pace a little bit and have a one-issue podcast, as we occasionally do. And the thing that we are going to talk about on this podcast is the Digital Public Library of America. Dan, I believe you have a bit of news related to the DPLA.
I have heard of it, yes.
You have heard of it?
Yes. So as probably our knowledgeable audience knows by this point, I'm going to be leaving the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media and my comfy professorship here at George Mason to take on the executive directorship of the DPLA. I couldn't be more excited. I'm, of course, sad to leave CHNM, which has been a big part of this podcast and a big part of putting history online, but I'm excited to kind of continue that mission writ large at a national scale with the Digital Public Library of America. So I'm really thrilled about it. It's exciting. I know and expect that a lot of the people who listen to this podcast who come from the museum and library and archive world and higher ed will be using the DPLA and will continue to be participating in, I think, its success. So it's great to be moving there. I'm going to continue to collaborate with the folks on this podcast and many others who I work with outside my office here on Mason's campus. But it's exciting.
So, Dan, can you tell us a little bit about where the DPLA is right now? If you wanted to give a short history of it, but certainly tell us what's going on right now with it.
Sure. So I think where we are now is a very exciting point, which is we are moving from the planning stages, which has taken place over the past couple of years, run by the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. David's been a part of it. I was a part of it on different work streams, work groups that are sort of thinking about different pieces like the technical piece and audience and use pieces things like that. So there's been a 2 to 3 year planning process that's gone on with a lot of ideas and a lot of involvement. Over 1,000 people have been involved. I think, Amanda, you were involved as well with this planning process. So I think there's been a lot of thinking, and now we're at that really fun point where the thinking becomes doing. And indeed, this podcast, I think, will be out probably a couple of weeks, 2 to 3 weeks before the launch, the official launch of the DPLA, as a spinning out and becoming an independent entity with a brand new spiffy website, which will be in a kind of prototype form, but I think will be very suggestive of what the DPLA is going to do, at least initially. And that will happen on April 18th. And we're going to have a live webcast and a very festive event at the Boston Public Library.
So I have one question, which actually came up recently. I was at VCU day before yesterday giving a talk, and they asked me what the DPLA is.
Right. So, yes, I was going to get to that next. So that's a great question. I think a really important one. And I think where we are now, the way I've been talking about the DPLA at this point is that we're going to start, obviously, when you go from planning, which always tends to be amorphous and a little blue sky, and obviously with lots of people involved, there's lots of ideas coming out. Obviously, when you move to implementation, you obviously need to sort of narrow things a bit and articulate exactly where you're going to start, even though you know in the back of your mind you'd like to do more things, down the line. So, but I think an easy way for the audience to understand where the DPLA will be starting in April is sort of three main missions. And they all begin with the letter P, so it's an easy mnemonic device for our audience. So the first is that we'll have a portal, which will be at dp.la, nice short URL that works on cell phones especially well. And that will be a place where you can go and access all of the material that we are aggregating from America's libraries, archives, and museums. So we are working with places, and we've already had some really big announcements just today. Art Store, which aggregates art from over 100 museums, came out with an announcement that they will be contributing thousands of images from their member museums to the DPLA. The National Archives has announced that they're going to be a big partner with the million items, Smithsonian as well, I think with around 1 million items. And you'll be hearing more about these kinds of announcements. And all of that content will be brought together in a really nice looking, easy to use site, where you can find materials from all of the participating libraries, archives, and museums. And not only that, but we're really modernizing, I think, the way people will access digital collections by having right off the bat some important ways to browse the collection. For instance, all of the items that we can get geocoded, in other words, that we can get latitude and longitude or place names associated with, you'll be able to browse those by a specific map. So if you're from Boise, you can zoom into a map and look at these materials in Boise, or what's available from the partners in that area. We'll also have a timeline and some other sort of tricks up our sleeves that David and other folks in the tech realm have been helping to enable. And I think we'll be looking at a variety of ways to kind of browse the collection using the metadata that we've collected from our partners. So first, there'll be a portal. I think it'll be a great way for students, researchers, the general public, scholars to sort of make their way through the entire collection, which will be millions of items, and I hope soon tens of millions of items from lots of places across the United States. Second, it will also be a platform. And by that, we mean that it will have an API or an application programming interface. So we're not just aggregating this metadata, we're sort of operationalizing it or providing a way for others, developers, researchers, to kind of build applications on top of it, to find their own ways to kind of sort through it and scan it. And again, David's done some really cutting edge work on this that I'm sure he'll talk about shortly. But because of the API, we're expecting that all kinds of groups, and it might be commercial app makers, smartphone app makers might want to use this material for local history. We could have researchers, Lev Manovich, who I think a lot of our audience knows as a very sophisticated new media and data mining expert, is really intrigued by new patterns and things he can find from the aggregate collection. And all the data itself will be downloadable in the same way that Wikipedia can be fully downloadable. So I think this notion of a platform and what you can build on top of the DPLA, we'll be hearing a lot more about that in 2013. Finally, I think the third main mission that you'll see at launch is that the DPLA really wants to be a very strong advocate for a public option in the 21st century. The name itself has public library in it, and I think we don't want to lose the fact that public libraries have played an incredibly important role in the United States and indeed in the world of providing free access. Indeed, as the Boston Public Library says at its entrance, free to all. And there's a lot to be gained by that. I think we're already in an age where many of our digital objects that we treasure, including things like books, are being wrapped with digital rights management and other forms of friction, which we understand from a kind of commercial standpoint. But there's always been a strong public option, or at least has been since the Carnegie libraries were set up in this country and others before that, of course, BPL being one of, or the first free municipal library, that have played a central role in our culture. And so we want to advocate for increasing the amount of materials and the kinds of materials that are in the public sphere, because we feel that that's a very important cultural good. So Portal, a platform, and the public option, advocacy for the public option, those are the sort of three main places that I think people will grasp right away that we're going to start with.
Well, thanks very much for that, Dan. I think that helps a lot. Now, Nick, I'd like to turn to you. You wrote a terrific article about a year ago called The Library of Utopia. And can you summarize a little bit what you said in that article and respond a little bit to what Dan has said about the plans for the DPLA?
Sure. And I should say that the article appeared in the MIT Technology Review. And what they asked me, and as you said, this was a year ago, was to provide a kind of overview of the DPLA effort from the outside, and both try to put it into context and get across some of the both some of the great worthiness of the mission, but also some of the criticisms that have been raised about it. And I started the article by putting this into a historical context, that the desire to build a universal library of this kind is one that's been around for a long time. H.G. Wells talked about it in his book World Brain back in 1938. He thought the technology that would enable a universal library would be microfilm. And as we know, that didn't quite work out. But this dream of a universal library has been in the culture for, you know, at least 100 years, probably before then. And so that raises a simple question, you know, why has that dream been frustrated? And a lot of it, I think, comes down to the limitations of the technology that have been available up till now. And so, of course, we now have in the internet, in fast computers and cheap storage, we have the technologies that go well beyond what was available with microfilm or CD-ROMs or any of the things that I've mentioned in the past. So to a large degree, and this doesn't, and I'm sure David will talk about the some of the technical issues and stuff, that doesn't mean that there aren't technical challenges, but it seems to me that the technical challenges, which were the dominant ones before, may no longer be the dominant ones. But there are other, you know, I tried to survey some of the other practical obstacles that might come up beyond the technical. Things like funding, particularly ongoing funding, to make sure, you know, that we don't have the, what we've seen on the internet in the past sometimes is that if you don't have ongoing way to fund these types of kind of very grand plans, then you can set something up and it can wither away. Also questions, more practical questions about metadata, how you get access to it and how you establish some uniformity so you can share these collections. And of course, copyright, which is probably the biggest and most ornery problem, since copyright restrictions have become so onerous over the last 20 or 30 years or so. So those are some of the practical issues. But then the real, what I found was the real controversy, the real source of kind of criticism, not so much criticism as a worry about the effort, has to do with something, you know, you asked Dan about and he talked about, which is the scope of the effort. And whether, in fact, we can say with confidence that the establishing a digital public library of America, and as Dan said, public library is right in the name, whether that won't have an effect on local public libraries, which, mm-hmm. No, are struggling with funding, struggling with their budgets. And as soon as you set up a universal public library, you immediately get the question, I think many, as this effort is rolled out, becomes better known, actually has a portal, the question is, how do you prevent it from being from city councils, others who control budgets, from pointing to this effort and saying, well, gee, we have this great central online digital public library of America. Do we really need to fund our own public library systems as we have in the past? Do we need to support their own digitization efforts? And some public librarians, and I'm sure there's a whole range of viewpoints, but some public librarians have raised, you know, their nervousness about that issue. Mm-hmm. And I guess it fits a lot. My own personal concern is probably even broader than that. And it's the issue of centralization versus decentralization on the internet. And there's an enormous tension between the kind of trend toward centralizing lots of ways to access information online, and what I think was one of the formative ideas of the net, which is to encourage decentralization and to avoid centralization. So today you have essentially one search engine. Some generous people would say two search engines, but basically one search engine, Google, that everybody goes to, and it's very, very difficult, as Microsoft continues to discover, to chip away at that. You have essentially one big social network, Facebook, that's taking over. You have one microblogging system, Twitter, that's essentially cornered the market there. I think you see some of these trends with MOOCs in the academic world. Mm-hmm. And the question is, will we see something similar with libraries as the DPLA launches and takes hold? Will it, as they say in the commercial space, will it kind of suck the oxygen out of smaller, local, decentralized efforts? And I do think that continues to be a real question. So beyond the issue of just protecting the funding in the future of local public libraries, in the diversity of local public libraries, do we run a risk of creating this kind of ultimately monolithic structure, even if it draws from lots of different collections? And is that a good thing, or is that a bad thing?
Well, thank you. That's very precise. I wondered about this issue of centralization versus decentralization myself, in a very technical kind of way. So it's certainly true that there are things called aggregators, which are sort of simultaneously centralized and decentralized at the same time, in the sense that they are gathering things from a number of different sources and bringing them into one giant portal. David and or Dan, can you tell us a little bit about what the actual technical infrastructure of the DPLA will be? Is it going to be planned as that kind of aggregator, or is it something that is more centralized even than that?
Yeah, so I'll let David take the tech side if you'd like. Let me just sort of respond as a segue from Nick's, I think, terrific comments. And certainly those are the questions I'm getting and I've gotten in the past few weeks since my appointment's been announced. I think they're really important ones. Just on the content side, I think it will become very clear after the launch, and even in this pre-launch period where we're getting these announcements, the way that the DPLA actually really complements local libraries. Local public libraries, 80% of the circulations are recent books and genre fiction and nonfiction, and they also play a kind of central public space role in the sort of civic society of towns and cities that obviously the DPLA can't replace. So I think it will become clear for a number of reasons how the DPLA is sort of pulling together all this amazing content from the United States that really doesn't normally reside in public libraries, but helps to sort of supplement them and help them to kind of pull together, for instance, exhibits on local history. But obviously, we'll hear a lot more about that. We won't be in the Stephen King's latest novel business. And so I think that will help to kind of allay these fears. And I actually haven't really heard those fears in the past month, at least since I've been sort of obviously paying a lot more attention. But they are important ones that I'm keeping in mind. I think on the tech side, and David can pick this up from here, I think the fact that we are pulling together metadata and doing it in a very sophisticated way also means that, in a sense, it's not entirely a centralized operation. And so, Amanda, I think you sort of started to put your finger on it, how it's both central and decentralized. David, do you want me to pass it over to you?
Sure. Although I think you hit it right on the head. And Nick, I too, those are really trenchant comments. And there, the situation you're describing is, as you certainly well know, is one of the most common sort of constellations on the net, where it is possible that the digitizing of, well, books or almost any other form of non-digital object can result in a disruption. But I think what Dan has said is exactly right. So first of all, there's the type of content. And then on the technical side, that's being aggregated. And on the technical side, as Dan says, it's metadata. That is information about the content. DPLA is not pulling in the stuff that it is taking you to. So for example, and the technical group, which I watch with admiration, has spent a lot of time and thought building technology that harvests metadata from 40 service hubs. These are statewide aggregations of cultural content. But you've never been able to search across those or begin to see the relationships among those pieces. By harvesting the metadata, again, not the content, but the information about that content, and pulling it together in a centralized place, you will be able to browse them seamlessly, and there are another set of really powerful results that accrue to the second, I think, really important characteristic of the technical approach. So the first is send out harvesters, be very smart about bringing in this metadata, keeping it up to date, and putting it into a form in which it can be queried across all the different boundaries of the collections. And that's not particularly easy, but it's being done really well. The second point I think to note about the technology is that it is, as Dan said right from the beginning, it's a platform. But this is platforms are not well understood by users, nor should they be. So let me just take a minute. When you use a piece of software, like, for example, you go to the DPLA and there's a beautiful front end, and you go browsing for content or visiting an exhibition, it's, of course, talking to a large collection of data that's being managed behind the scenes by the DPLA. So the user doesn't have to manage it. The way that a platform works and the way that DPLA works is that what you will see on April 18th when it launches, what you, the user, will see will be a very usable and friendly front end, but it's only one possible way of browsing through this large collection. As a platform, the DPLA is enabling any other developer to create whatever sort of application he or she wants to that will use whatever metadata content is in the DPLA. This is an incredibly powerful idea because it means that, let's just say, you go to the site on April 18th and you love it, but you say, oh, you know what, I would really like it if it would suit my needs better if I could browse this way or that way, or if I could get recommendations based on this or that, or if I knew that it was child safe, you know, I'm only browsing works, excuse me, not child safe, but only works for children, or only works about ancient Greece, or whatever it is. With a platform approach, any developer can build whatever utility front end that she wants to against this platform, which means that doesn't have to be a single DPLA. There will be one thing at the site, dp.la, but other groups can create their own ways of finding value in this collection. They do this through APIs or application programming interfaces. There's a lot of technology there. It's an incredibly powerful way of getting the most possible use and value out of the information that DPLA is collecting.
Can I just mention that I had an epiphany recently that the best possible metaphor for this platforminess or for extensibility in general when it comes to software or infrastructure is Mr. Potato Head. So that you have to imagine these kinds of things as a Mr. Potato Head, and you can invent your own eyes and noses and lips and stick them into the slots, as it were. I don't know if that's a fair metaphor for the DPLA.
It's actually our mascot. It's we weren't supposed to reveal that until April 18th.
It's yet another P.
Yeah.
Portal, platform, public.
Mr. Potato.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking, Amanda, that would actually make a really good going away present for Dan as a Mr. Potato Head.
I will always treasure it.
Let me give us a different but food-related metaphor. Another way of looking at it, which also involves potatoes, is that you can build a restaurant that has a set menu and expert chefs who deliver delicious food, and a very high percentage of people will be very happy. But inevitable. Not everybody will be, because they like different things, and there are going to be some of the damn vegetarians, sorry, I'm a damn vegetarian, or whatever, have special needs and want their food done differently, or no gluten and the rest of it, or they really want Russian cuisine. With a platform approach, it's much more like being a kitchen, and there will be a lovely restaurant called dp.la you can go to, and a lot of people are going to be really happy with it. But there are going to be people who want to make scholarly use or local use or whatever, and they're going to have that entire kitchen available to them to create their own restaurant or whatever.
Mills, I think you had something to add.
Yeah, I was going to say on the question of sort of concentration of resources or taking resources away from local public libraries, I guess I'm a little less concerned about that, only because I'm somebody who spends a lot of time in local public libraries and has over the years, they're only barely really libraries in the way that we sort of what we conjure up in our mind when we think of a place full of books that people read and check out. Increasingly, they are the place where people who can't afford to be connected to the internet go to connect to the internet. They are the place where people who don't speak English as their native language go to have informal English lessons. They're the place where community groups like Alcoholics Anonymous and others meet. They've become community centers which also have books. And so I guess my concern would be not so much that the library itself would be in trouble, but more that their acquisitions budgets might be a little bit impacted by kind of a lack of understanding of exactly what Dan said, which is that the DPLA is not going to be in the Stephen King Nora Roberts business, but instead in a different kind of business. But, you know, if I'm a city councilman or a county board of supervisors person and I'm trying to cut budget somewhere, it might be attractive to me to say, oh, well, we can just cut some money out of the library budget because there's this digital library now. But I think that public libraries do have a they have so many other functions now that have nothing to do with books. Actually, I had a question for Dan, and that is related to this issue of metadata, and that's the degree of interoperability of the DPLA project with other big aggregation projects, and I'm thinking primarily Europeana here. Mm-hmm. Can you talk just a little bit more about that?
Yes, so I think that's a great point. I mean, I feel that the DPLA is, you know, is in some sense one step to a kind of world digital public library. I'm already in, you know, talking to the folks at Europeana and expect to have a very strong relationship with them. And indeed, the technical team and Workstream have been deeply in conversation, because indeed we use a kind of modified version of Europeana's data model, EDM, the Europeana data model. We've sort of taken that and added a few bells and whistles to do some fancy things that I think our savvy listeners know about. We're adding things like RDF and all kinds of linked data hooks to a metadata scheme that then you can do some really fun things with as a developer or as a digital humanities researcher or what have you. So I think the goal absolutely is to have the DPLA and Europeana be interoperable. And in fact, there are other places, Australia, for instance, which Tim, our friend of the show, Tim Sherratt, has just been appointed to the head of Trove Australia, which is a kind of DPLA for Australia that's been aggregating some of their archival material. And so I think, sure, if we can figure out a way to globally allow for this kind of interoperability, then I think we're really working with something. And I think something that Bob Darton and others have pointed out about the DPLA is, you know, it's American collections, but it actually holds materials from the world. There are materials from all over that are in America's libraries, archives, and museums. And I think by, in a sense, making them available in this way and through APIs, I think those other places will be able to kind of pull back and find their materials wherever they are globally. So that's really exciting to me.
Can I ask, too? Go ahead.
I just want to throw in a word about the interoperability. The technical team has been very, very, it's very aware of the need not to create yet another standard. It's been following what I think are very good practices in striking the balance between using existing standards whenever possible and doing sort of standards-based extensions when it needs to because of the particularities of the system. So it's a great point. The technical team is it's behaving very well.
I had understood that the DPLA was going to focus on text-based materials first. So do I understand that you're getting away from that with partnerships with ArtStore and things like that?
Right. So what's nice about the DPLA is it's very modular. Depending on different kinds of funding streams, we can sort of add different things into the collection rather than doing it all in one fell swoop. And I think this also goes back to Nick's point about copyright as well. The easiest materials, not easy in the process or the amount of money it takes, but the most unencumbered material that we can add to the collection are those from cultural heritage institutions where the material is already in the public domain. And these are amazing materials. I mean, you don't have to be a professional historian like me to be really excited by the fact that there are in this first round, and we haven't talked about this yet on the podcast, but there are these 7 state or regional hubs, what are called service hubs, that are working then at the local level with everything from kind of small mom and pop historic sites that have, you know, a few hundred items that they've scanned and added metadata to, all the way up to very large state institutions, University of Kentucky Library that is running the Kentucky side of this that has, you know, thousands or millions of objects ultimately that can be added. So actually, the very first stuff to go into the DPLA has been this historical content, cultural heritage content from these 7 state and regional hubs. And so in that way, this is all kinds of material. I mean, there are manuscripts and letters and diaries. There is material culture, which we've had a lot of experience talking about here at the Center for History and New Media. Photographs of you know, three-dimensional objects, things like that. That's a big part of history and the study of culture. And as you mentioned, Amanda, we also have artwork going in. So I think, and especially, I mean, I loved Nick's article as well, but I think probably what colored the early views of the DPLA was that the forerunner was Google Books, and it was books, right? It was an emphasis on text. And I want text. I would love to get millions of books into the DPLA, perhaps starting with this similar kind of green light stuff that we're getting from the hubs, that is the public domain material, which, alas, is really only solidly apparent in pre-1923 books in the United States, but it's still millions of books. And we will work on that. But I think already, just from this podcast, I think the audience will get the sense that it's going to be the full range of human expression, not just books or texts, but all kinds of texts, published and unpublished, and then also all kinds of visual culture, scientific materials, data sets, those kinds of things. So we're really looking at the full range of human expression. I think it's very ambitious, but it also allows for a kind of modular funding as different kinds of institutions come in and say, you know, we want to contribute, and here's the kind of material we have.
So when it launches in April 18th, are we also talking about multimedia materials, audio, video, that kind of thing?
I think we are working on some video material. I've had a couple of talks that I don't want to reveal on the podcast, but with some major providers of video content, archival video content. So I think those are the kinds of things that, sure, we want that to be in there as well.
Great. Well, I had to, we'll let you go, Dan, and I want to mention here before we wind up that this was all my idea. This was not Dan's attempt to hog the microphone. He graciously agreed to do it when it was my idea. I did want to return to another point that Nick had raised, actually, which was about the funding structure of the DPLA, because certainly I, in some ways, you know, the DPLA almost seems like an attempt to wrest some of the portalness to the internet from Google, at least in terms of cultural heritage materials, for sure. But at the same time, the DPLA is not specifically a government organization. It's not national in that sense. Can you talk a little bit about the funding and organizational structure of the DPLA and how that relates to maybe commercial enterprises like Google?
Sure. You know, there's obviously still some question marks about this. We're launching with very strong support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, which is also a big supporter in the planning stages. I'm hopeful we'll get some other big national funders on board as well. I think it's a compelling idea, and you know, obviously a big part of my job is to go out there and get sustainability for the organization. You know, I think in this way, again, we're different than Europeana, which had considerable, and I believe still has considerable EC funding. You know, I think that maybe in the long run, if we prove ourselves, there will be government or state, you know, federal, state, or local kinds of funding or partial funding for the DPLA, and that's something certainly we could explore if it was felt that we were providing a kind of value service as a layer on top of America's libraries. You know, that's, I think, something that I would hope for in the future. But I also think that we will be in some sense more decentralized in the way that we're supported than Europeana, which Europeana has also gotten grants. But I think we'll be looking, at a variety of funders to, again, come in and fund the kinds of things that are important to them. There are very large American foundations that really want to focus on education, and we'd like to have educational programs that kind of use the material in there. We have library programs that we'd like to initiate to partner more strongly with local public libraries to bring local history online. And there are funders that I think would be very appropriate for that. So I think it will be, in some sense, a little bit more piecemeal, but I think that first, you know, we need to prove ourselves as providing a compelling service. And I think our experience here at Mason has been that, you know, when you have an institution that, you know, provides an important and good service, that funders do step forward. And I think ultimately, I think the DPLA will end up being a fairly cheap date, to be honest. I think for, you know, relatively small amount of money, we'll be able to, again, kind of operationalize and make more freely available so much content that that really, you know, on a kind of run rate, it's not a hugely expensive enterprise. But of course, digitizing all of America's libraries, arts, and museums is a very large enterprise, and that's where I think we'll have different kinds of programs that will fund things at the local level, and we'll add a little bit in to be able to kind of send this upstream to DPLA so people can find it and get traffic to their local digital archives. But you know, it's clearly going to be a challenge, and one that I'll be focusing on in the coming years.
Great. Well, thanks for being in the hot seat, Dan. I don't know if anybody else has any other comments, questions. Now is the time.
This is Nick. I'll just come back briefly to the to the original question of centralization and decentralization, because I'm not entirely, I haven't been put entirely at ease. And it's I certainly see how you can be both a portal and a platform. But as I said, there is a kind of centripetal force that we've seen on the net that tends to put more and more power and traffic into one portal rather than diffusing it. And this is a personal matter for me, because I've been a self-employed freelance nonfiction writer for 10 years. I don't have any affiliation with a university, so I'm entirely dependent on public libraries. And you know, it's true to say that they've kind of, one of their functions has shifted to internet cafe / community center, but it's more than that. And right now, I live in Boulder, Colorado. I do enormous amounts of textual research through the local portal of my local public library. And I go there, I search for books, for journal articles, I search their collection, and if they don't have it, and we're talking about pretty esoteric books from, you know, 100 years ago or whatever, I click on a button to go to the broader local network called Prospector, which pulls in University of Colorado, Colorado State University. Almost always, in fact, I can't even think of a time when I haven't been able to find a particular resource, and I click on it, and within 3 days, I drive down to my local branch and I pick up that book or that article. So there's an enormous amount, and I've had a similar experience when I lived in Massachusetts in a very small town. So there's an enormous amount that is already available through local efforts and local online efforts as well. And so I'm still worried that as soon as you create a centralized portal and give it a lot of publicity, you're going to make it very, very difficult not only to keep your acquisitions budget up, but to continue to fund those local kind of online efforts, which, you know, as a fairly intensive user of public libraries, has fulfilled my needs. And so looking beyond the, you know, internet cafe community center model of the local public library, there's a lot of people employed in doing this. There's a lot of local efforts involved. And I still think it's not clear to me how the DPLA does not intrude on those local efforts.
So this is David. Let me try to reassure Nick. And Nick, none of us should be entirely reassured about the future of public libraries, but I don't think that this is a DPLA. I don't think the DPLA is aggravating that. There are other broad reasons why libraries are being challenged. So three-part answer. The first is that this is a local decision. If you do not want the metadata about your content, that is the information about your content, if you don't want it aggregated by the DPLA, then you won't do it. So some libraries will, some won't. These large service hubs that are statewide collections, a good number of them have decided they would like to have the information about their collections. And those who don't, they don't have to. The second is that it is, again, the metadata. So if you find something that you're interested in and you click on it, and within the DPLA, you're sent back to the place where the content lives, which is in the local libraries or the service hubs and the rest. At least that's generally how it will work. And third of all, this is two parts. First is that this will let you as a researcher or just as a citizen do something that you could not do before, which is to do searches across collections that you probably didn't even know existed. And to do a single search and find all sorts of materials, the riches that are there in the local collections, in the statewide collections, in the university collections and so forth, in the museums and the archives, this stuff will now be visible to you in a way that you in a practical way, you just couldn't have done before, because you would have had to go to each of the individual libraries. And this is not being done by Facebook or by Google. This is being done by a group that is 100% committed in its charter to, as far as I can tell, to open access and to making all of this information completely reusable, not locked in to the proprietary platform that's trying to sell ads against it, because that's not what the DPLA will do. All of this information will be available to anybody else who wants to put it to a different use. They don't like the way, that's the platform point of view. This information will be available for others to use. It is not locked in, it is opened up. And so for those three reasons, I don't think this is the challenge to local libraries.
I would just add, I think that's a good point. Unfortunately, local libraries are getting their budgets cut pre-DPLA, which is very sad for me as a heavy public library user with my kids, and a heavy user of Mason's Library, which is also a public library funded by the state of Virginia. Response on this and is that when I go to my library here at Mason, a lot of the great databases that I'm looking through are aggregations from the commercial space. They are huge databases that Mason pays for and pays increasingly every year, regardless of what the inflation rate is. They pay more and more of our budget to these giant commercial aggregations from Elsevier and Wiley and other places. So I see a sort of threat from the other side of this, where if a public entity like the DPLA that has just a strong commitment to publicness can't come in and do some of this, that we're going to cede that ground to the Googles or to the ProQuests, who come in and scan backgrounds of America's newspapers and then charge tens of thousands of dollars a year for Mason to subscribe to it. So I think at least having the option that there'll be something open and public, I think is important. But, as David said, and I can confirm, I mean, it will not allay all of these fears. And I think it's just something that we're going to have to continue to work on in general at the DPLA.
All right. Well, thanks very much. And we will continue the conversation online, including at digitalcampus.tv, where this will be posted. And thanks very much for being with us. And to our audience, we will see you on another edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not.